This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Martin, and we're here once again to answer your questions.
This is Doug, and I'm calling from Fargo, North Dakota.
Hi, this is Linda from Texas.
My name is Linda Swallow. I'm from Baltimore.
I'm 86 years old.
My husband and I are awaiting his green card.
I'm wondering how the pandemic is impacting the U.S. immigration process.
This worries me.
Can someone with viral antibodies still be contagious?
Does the sheer fact that I had a positive flu test imply that I did not have COVID?
Can this be true?
When the antibody tests are available, who will be able to get them?
Thank you.
NPR journalists and outside experts are with us to offer solid facts, to tell you what we know, and to correct some of the misinformation that's floating around. And when we don't know something, we'll tell you that too. Please send us any questions you have about health, the economy, or the realities of how we're living right now, even haircuts, to npr.org/nationalconversation. On Twitter, you can use the hashtag NPRConversation. But every night we begin by answering the question, what happened today? The House votes tomorrow on the latest coronavirus relief package. It includes funding for small businesses, hospitals, and testing. Here is Speaker of the House, Democrat Nancy Pelosi.
If we want to open the country, if we want to open our economy, the key to that is testing, testing, testing.
The death toll from the virus in the U.S. is now more than 46,000 people. Officials in California trace two of those deaths to February.
I think what these deaths tell us is that community transmission had arrived much earlier than we were able to detect it. And I think it really highlights the importance of the shelter in place in protecting the community and preventing hospitalizations and deaths from COVID-19.
The mayor of Las Vegas, where tourism is critical to the economy, is pushing to reopen the city's hotels and casinos. New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo says he feels the pressure to reopen, too.
If we make a bad move, it's going to set us back. We can't make a bad decision. This is no time to act stupidly. I don't know how else to say it.
President Trump has signed an executive order halting immigration into the U.S. for 60 days.
We have to take care of our patients. We have to take care of our great American workers. And that's what we're doing. So I've just signed it just before coming into the room. And very important.
We want to focus on that issue for a while longer. So we've called reporter Michelle Hackman. She covers immigration policy for The Wall Street Journal. Michelle Hackman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So as we just heard, President Trump signed an executive order that he says will suspend immigration for people seeking green cards for 60 days, adding that the measure was needed to protect U.S. workers. We just heard him say that. But there are some exceptions for temporary workers. So can you just walk us through who will be affected by this?
Yeah. So the president tweeted on Monday night that he was suspending immigration. But what he actually signed tonight is much more narrow than that. The president is suspending new green cards for people applying outside the country with some exceptions. So, you know, people who are applying to come here and work, people who are applying through the diversity visa lottery, people who are getting sponsored by family members to move here, can't put in applications for green cards to move here for the next 2 months and possibly longer. But there are big exceptions to that rule. You know, even among family members, Americans can still bring over their spouses. They can bring over their children. And all temporary visas, so people who are coming here on H-1B visas, those are the high-skilled immigrant visas, migrant seasonal workers, anyone, a student visa, all those people can still apply for visas. If you're living in the United States, you actually are not impacted by this order at all. And so it's a much smaller number than we were envisioning. It's about, you know, 25,000 people a month, potentially.
Michelle, you know that at the same time, both U.S. borders have been closed. Both the southern border and the northern border have been closed for non-essential travel. A lot of the international travel has been put on hold due to the pandemic. So how does this play into what's already in place?
You're totally getting at the right question. You know, the president signed an order today, but really his administration has been curtailing most immigration for weeks. In March, you know, he, as you said, shut down both borders, particularly has been turning away any sort of immigrant crossing the border illegally. Even those who are asking for asylum, for protection here, they're turning back, which is sort of almost unprecedented. That hasn't happened sort of in modern American history. He also, as you know, has blocked travel from China, blocked travel from Europe, and, you know, visa processing at most consulates around the world has stopped anyway. So, you know, very few people are able to come here as is.
So let's get to some listener questions on this subject. First, we have Haley in Portland, Oregon.
I'm wondering how the pandemic is impacting the U.S. immigration process. My husband lives in London, and we started his green card application in March 2019. We're now finally at the point where we're waiting to get his interview date. However, given that the consulates are all mostly closed, I'm wondering if USCIS has a plan for how they're going to address this growing backlog of cases in an already overtaxed system.
Michelle, what do you think?
It's a really good question. You know, technically, your husband, Haley, is okay under this executive order that the president just signed. His case is going to move forward. He can still qualify for his green card. But the question you raised is a really good one. You know, most of your consulates around the world are closed. Immigration offices in the U.S. are largely shut down. And so visa processing is moving slower than it was before. And so it's possible that you may face delay.
Let's go to a question from Mark in Washington.
My question is about the stimulus check or lack of. My wife is a legal permanent resident. She received her Social Security number when she immigrated in August 2019. I'm a U.S. citizen. We have a two-year-old daughter. Our income is well within the limits for a full-size stimulus check, and everyone I've asked for has received their checks, but we haven't. But this worries me. Yesterday, I read an article in the LA Times that said, families with an immigrant spouse will receive no stimulus, even if the other family members are U.S. citizens. Now, that's paraphrase, but the article did say that in no uncertain terms, and maybe the reporter was overgeneralizing, but can this be true?
Michelle, I want to mention here that we have heard this from a number of other listeners. So what do we know about this?
You know, it's a serious concern. the rule of thumb that you're going to want to use here is that if you are a person filing your taxes with a Social Security number and everyone who's on your tax return, so your spouse, your kids, if everyone has a Social Security number, then you should be good to go. You should qualify for your stimulus check. There are very narrow exceptions to that. Either if you have entered the country extremely recently, you might not qualify. However, the bigger thing to note is that people who are filing tax returns with members of families who are undocumented immigrants and file taxes with using something called an individual tax identification number, you know, that's something where undocumented immigrants who want to file taxes still can, or even, you know, people here living in the United States, like spouses of visa holders who are not able to work, still want to file taxes, can. But if you are filing jointly with a person who does not have a Social Security number, nobody in the house gets a stimulus check. And so this is going to impact possibly tens of millions of families with undocumented family members.
I think I have time for one more. And this is Linda in Baltimore.
I have a friend who is a legal asylee and has a work permit. I was wondering if she is qualified to get the stimulus payment.
Okay. Michelle, as quickly as you can.
Sure. Good question. She has a Social Security number, so yes, she can get a stimulus payment, and she can also file for unemployment.
All right. Michelle Hackman, thanks so much. Michelle Hackman covers immigration policy for the Wall Street Journal. We really appreciate your being here. Thank you.
Thank you.
And joining us now is NPR senior science editor and correspondent Rob Stein. Rob, welcome back once again.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I think we're going to hear from you again later, but we know that Congress is including billions in the next relief bill to ramp up testing. What's this money going to pay for, and how do you think it'll help?
Yeah, it's a big boost for testing. It's the latest relief package contains $25 billion for testing. The bulk of the money, $11 billion, is going directly to state and local governments to do all sorts of things that is urgently needed, really, to scale up testing. That includes things like, you know, hiring staff to work in testing labs, buy the tests themselves and the equipment, and buy crucial supplies to do the tests, you know, things like swabs to collect the samples and special chemicals to transport specimens and extract and analyze the genetic material in the virus. That's really important because those have all been running really short and creating real problems for trying to keep up with the huge demand in testing. The funding also requires the federal government and each state to come up with specific strategies to finally have enough testing, and that should help. And the money could also be used to track people down who've had contact with infected people, so-called contact tracing, which is really important to try to keep the virus in check. Some of the money will also help employers test workers, and the CDC will get about $1 billion to do things like expand its testing capacity. The NIH will get $2 billion to do things like develop new tests. So all of this should help a lot.
Well, we're going to hear from you later. We have a lot of questions about testing, Rob, as you surely know. So we're going to look forward to that. That's NPR senior science editor and correspondent Rob Stein. Rob, thanks again. Talk to you soon.
Sure thing.
You can hear much more of our extensive coverage when you download the NPR One app. Go to the Explore tab and click on the coronavirus outbreak for our curated stream of stories. And if you have questions, remember, we want to help. Go to npr.org/national conversation or on social media. Use that hashtag NPR conversation. Up next, we're going to answer your questions on a sensitive subject, advance directives. This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Martin. The coronavirus pandemic has been a reminder for many of us to make sure our affairs are in order. Yesterday, we took questions about wills and estate planning. Today, we're looking at advance directives. These are documents that spell out your preferences when it comes to end-of-life medical care. And we've brought on an expert to help answer your questions on this topic. Dr. Jessica Zitter is a critical and palliative care specialist and author of Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. Dr. Zitter, thanks so much for joining us.
So happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I just want to start by saying these are hard conversations for a lot of people to have. So I want to thank the people who sent in their questions for thinking these things through and showing us, you know, how you can talk about these things. Dr. Zitter, of course, I'm grateful to you for answering them. And I'm going to ask you to remind us about why you might want to think about advance directives.
Well, an advance directive really is such an important thing to have. It really helps to make sure that your preferences are honored at the end of life. And we're all sort of confronting that vision. We see it's up close and personal with the COVID-19 epidemic, pandemic. So, you know, COVID or not, there's a time when further intervention in the hospital just isn't going to help and actually can make things worse or increase suffering. So, you know, the default in our healthcare system is to just keep treating, keep adding on machines, connecting people to life support. And often, you know, this happens until someone dies. And then there's just a rising number of deaths in facilities where patients are just living on machinery. And it's really not what people say they would want in their lives. So that's why planning in advance and creating an advance directive and thinking about these things is such a critically important process. And again, I want to say one more thing, which is that the advance directive is not just a static form. It's a process of thinking about your values and thinking about how that will translate into what you want at the end of life and communicating that very important information to your loved ones who will be the ones who would have to speak for you if you can't speak for yourself.
So let's go to our listeners' questions. Here's Helen from the Bay Area.
I've heard that outcomes for COVID-19 patients who have to go on respirators are not especially good. Can you tell me more about these outcomes? I'm updating my advance directive, and I'd like to make choices based on likely outcomes. Thank you.
Dr. Zitter, I can tell you a number of people are asking about the survival rate of people who are put on ventilators. Can you tell us something about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the data that's been coming out, and again, this is an evolving situation, but the data that we're seeing in terms of people who go on ventilators with coronavirus is not looking very optimistic. I mean, most of the studies I've seen show fewer than 50% of people surviving. And, you know, being on a ventilator does not mean that you're going to live. So, you know, it's worse for those who are elderly and frail or who have underlying health conditions. And what's interesting is that this is also true in non-COVID times. These are some of the same types of statistics that we see. The National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization has what they're calling a COVID shared decision-making tool, which kind of helps you assess your likelihood of surviving COVID based on your age, your comorbidities, your, you know, other health conditions and current symptoms. And that could be something that can help you think about your preferences for treatment in the context of getting ill with COVID, including, you know, where you'd want to be, whether you'd want to focus primarily on comfort or on various degrees of life-saving effort.
And some people aren't just worried about survival. They want to know about quality of life. So here's a question in that vein.
Hi, this is Linda from Texas. How many people have fully recovered after being on a ventilator for COVID-19? And what residual effects do they have after being on the ventilator?
Okay, doctor?
Yeah, well, again, you know, as I said just a second ago, that, you know, we're seeing fewer than 50% of people who are going on ventilators are surviving. And we're still, again, in the early stages of knowing what's going to happen with these survivors. We've certainly seen some people leave the hospitals and to great rounds of applause, and everyone's excited. But there's a lot of concern that there will be some longstanding problems in terms of quality of life for those people. There's something called the post-ICU syndrome that happens for people, again, before COVID ever came into being, that patients who go into ICUs often don't, you know, come out with significant problems, whether cognitively, emotional, mental health, physical function. Some examples are, you know, 64% of survivors of ICU stays had problems with mobility at 6 months, and 32% had difficulties with just basic activities of daily living at 3 months. And, you know, as it impacts families, for example, a quarter of people coming out of ICU stays like that needed more than 50 hours per week of family caregiving. So this is a really important thing to know. It exists pre and post COVID, and it's possibly even worse with COVID, and there's some concern, and we're going to have to see how things go.
Let's listen to this next caller.
Hello, this is Anna Lou Perrineau. I'm calling from Beaverton, Oregon. I'm 86 years old and have an advance directive stating no life support, palliative care only. I don't want to be intubated, but I would like some assurance that my pacemaker will be disconnected and that I will be allowed to die without too much suffering. How can I assure that my directive will be respected?
Again, Dr. Zetter, I think this is a question that a lot of people have. Is it possible that a doctor or family members would go against the directives of a patient?
Well, you know, what I've seen far more commonly than that is that people just don't know what a person's preferences are. And that is such a tragedy that conversation hasn't happened. You know, it's very, very important. And this is why the advanced directive is such an important exercise to take on. And I want to just make a shout out to an organization that I think is really important, prepareforyourcare.org, which helps people to bring their values into alignment with the decisions that they would want vis-a-vis ventilators, vis-a-vis going to the hospital, vis-a-vis their pacemaker, et cetera. So it's very, very important to think about your values and make those decisions about specific medical treatments, but also to identify who that surrogate person is going to be and make sure that they know about those preferences.
And I have a question that speaks to that. This is from Joe McIntyre of Albuquerque, who wrote us and asked, should we carry our advance directive with us in case we don't want to be put on a ventilator and would prefer to die? I don't know, Dr. Zitter, what about that? How do you make sure your advance directive is seen by the people who need to see it?
Well, this is where it gets complicated. You know, there are a couple of different kinds of forms. There's the advance directive, and there's also something called a pulsed form. That's a physician order for life-sustaining treatment. If you are really, really sure that there is a specific treatment that you do not want to have, then it might benefit you to talk to your physician about signing an order, a doctor's order. An advance directive is not a doctor's order. This is an actual doctor's order saying, do not intubate this person. So I would recommend that people think about having that conversation with their physicians.
Well, thank you for this. You're an expert on palliative care. We don't have a lot of time left. We only have about a minute, but have you seen examples of humane care for people who are not being put on ventilators? What have you seen? As briefly as you can, please.
Well, I want to reassure you all that humanity and compassion should be a part of every level of medical care, whether you're getting full care in the ICU or you're getting support for dying.
Okay, that's Dr. Jessica Zitter. She's a critical and palliative care specialist and author of Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow, we're giving career advice for students graduating from college during this crisis, and we'll tackle how to cut your own hair while socially distancing. Send us your questions on these topics by going to npr.org/nationalconversation. On Twitter, use that hashtag NPR Conversation. This is The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News. This is The National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Martin. We know that you have a lot of questions about testing for COVID-19. How effective are the tests? Why does it seem to take so long to get results? And why does it seem so hard to even get one? So we've brought in NPR senior science editor and correspondent Rob Stein to answer as many of your questions as we can. Rob, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, Michelle.
So let's start with a question from Shoreline, Washington. Here is Martin.
Unless the test can show that one has 100% immunity, what good does it serve other than being a momentary snapshot of one's health? Conceivably, one could get a negative result and then, even moments later, could be infected.
So Rob, yeah. Is there more than just one test out there?
Yeah. Well, there are a bunch of different tests, but Martin is, he's spot on. When someone tests negative, that just means they were negative at the moment they were swabbed. They could get infected the moment they walk out of the door of the doctor's office or the next day or the next week. So that's important to remember. And it's also important to remember that, these tests aren't perfect. A negative test could be wrong for lots of different reasons. Maybe the sample wasn't collected the right way, or maybe there wasn't enough virus there yet when the sample was tested. And there are, as you mentioned, a variety of tests being used, and they're not all the same. In fact, some recent research indicated that the fast test that's out there that everybody's excited about, that could miss the most infections of any of the tests that are out there, maybe 15 out of every 100 infected people. So, for all those reasons, you can't let your guard down if you test negative. You can't be lulled into a, false sense of security.
And then the premise of his question, right, is that one could get a negative test and then you could be infected shortly thereafter, right? I mean, the premise is accurate, correct?
Yeah, absolutely, okay. Right. Yeah. But that said, it's important to test people because, you want to know if somebody is infected so they can get the treatment they need and they could be isolated to protect them from infecting other people, and anybody that they came into contact with could be, tested to see if they have it and to stop the virus from spreading.
All right. Our next question is about antibody tests. Let's listen.
Hello, this is Doug, and I'm calling from Fargo, North Dakota. When the antibody tests are available, who will be able to get them? Will they be rationed like the virus swab? And how accurate will they be?
Okay, Rob, what do we know?
Yeah, so, that is an entirely different kind of test. An antibody test doesn't look for the virus in people's bodies. It looks for proteins in the blood produced by the immune system to fight off the virus, the antibodies. And it doesn't tell you if you're infected at that moment because it takes time for your body to produce those antibodies. Instead, it tells you whether you might have been exposed to the virus in the past. So it's not used to diagnose someone, but potentially a positive antibody test could be used to see if someone had developed immunity to the virus. But that's still a big question. In fact, the FDA is really worried about some of these companies that are out there hawking these tests and marketing the people, saying you should test this to see if you're immune. We don't really know if that's the case yet, but if eventually it turns out to be the case, hopefully they will be widely available.
Our next question comes from Sharon in Seattle, who wants to know about antibodies and contagiousness.
Can someone with viral antibodies still be contagious? Does viral load make a difference in the severity of symptoms and degree of immunity in a patient who's recovered?
And Rob, of course, I'm going to ask you to explain what viral load means for people who aren't familiar with that term.
Right, viral load. Well, viral load is, basically what it sounds like. It's the load. It's the amount of virus in someone's body. And it may affect, things like how sick someone gets or how much immunity they develop. Or a high viral load could also increase someone's chances of spreading the virus to someone else. But, because this virus is so new, we really don't know the answer to any of those questions for sure, including whether someone who has developed antibodies can still spread the virus.
If you have a question about testing for NPR's Rob Stein, please send it to us at npr.org/nationalconversation or share it on social media using the hashtag NPR Conversation. Okay, Rob, we've got a lot for you. Here's a question from Ellen in Antwerp, New York.
If we don't have enough rapid tests to understand the pandemic throughout the country, couldn't we designate a small percentage of the total supply to mass test a few locations to give us some understanding of how the virus is spreading?
Rob?
Yeah, so, you know, these rapid tests, they have been prioritized to some degree around the country, you know, to the hot spots around the country where testing is really needed most urgently. But there really just hasn't been enough of these fast tests to really do mass testing anywhere. They've really been used to do things like, you know, check out healthcare workers like doctors and nurses to see if they're infected and check out, you know, hospital patients before they admit them to the ICU. But the company that makes that test is ramping up production, so we should get more of those tests hopefully soon. To do the sort of thing that, you know, Ellen's suggesting, researchers are trying to do that using the antibody testing that we were talking about earlier. You know, some of those results indicate that the virus has been circulating much more widely than many people thought, and that could have big implications for understanding really the scope of the epidemic in the country and how to fight it. But it's hard to reach any firm conclusions about that yet, too, and so scientists are urgently trying to clarify that picture.
We had a number of people who asked about COVID-19 and the flu, so I'm just going to throw just one of those questions at you. This is from Blake, who told us that last month he traveled to San Francisco from Seattle and back, and here it is.
Mm-hmm. I became ill with COVID-like symptoms, fever, cough. At that time, I went to urgent care, was unable to get a COVID test, but I tested positive for influenza A. My question is, does the sheer fact that I had a positive flu test imply that I did not have COVID?
Rob, what do we know? Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's possible that Blake, you know, could have had the bad luck of being infected by both viruses at the same time. But, you know, chances are if Blake tested positive for the flu, she probably had the flu. You know, a positive flu test says nothing about COVID. These tests are totally different. You know, but the only way that testing between the flu and the coronavirus is overlapping doesn't apply to any individual patients like Blake per se. But how that does apply is that the systems that have been used for years to monitor the flu season every year are now being kind of adapted to try to monitor the coronavirus epidemic by tracking down things like how many people are showing up at the doctor with fevers and coughs and ending up in the hospital with pneumonia, that sort of thing.
I think we have time to squeeze in one more before we need to take a short break. And Rob, you're nice enough to stay with us. Here is a question from Alyssa in Acton, Massachusetts, and she wants to know about the phased reopenings of certain states.
I've heard that in order to reopen the country, we need the capacity to test many more people and to perform contact tracing to identify hotspots and quickly reintroduce social distancing measures when they're necessary. Who are the leaders who are responsible for each of these capabilities, and how do we know what progress we're making towards these goals?
Rob?
Yeah, so those jobs are largely falling to the states, and they're scrambling to get enough testing and to build up, legions of contact tracers to try to keep the virus in check and keep big outbreaks from flaring up again. And, you know, there have really been lots of complaints that the federal response hasn't been helping them enough. The one measure to know whether you're doing enough testing is whether 10% of your tests are coming back positive. Right now, we're getting a lot more than that, so that's an indication that we're not doing enough testing.
We need to take a short break, and Rob, I think you're nice enough to stay with us. We hope you will stay with us, because this is the National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News. And we're back with NPR senior science editor and correspondent Rob Stein, who's taking questions about testing. Okay, let's see what else we have. Okay, there's Katie in Chicago who thinks she's had COVID-19 already, and she says her husband, who is a police detective, will get tested tomorrow. Let's listen to the rest of their question.
Considering the lack of testing available for mild cases, is there any way for citizens who suspect they may have contracted COVID-19 but have subsequently recovered to know for certain? And if they have recovered, then what are the potential risks they pose to those who have not been exposed?
Rob?
Yes. So, you know, that's one of the frustrating things about the lack of testing is a lot of people out there who really want to know, you know, that have an answer for that very reason. They want to know whether they're, you know, they have to be worried about infecting their family members or that sort of thing. Unfortunately, without testing, there really is no way to know for sure. But the CDC says that people who, you know, had COVID-19 or think they might have had it can stop isolating themselves when they've been fever-free for 72 hours. That's 3 days after the fever ends. And that's, you know, that's without using, you know, fever-reducing medicine like ibuprofen or something like that. And any respiratory symptoms of the disease, you know, coughing, shortness of breath, should have improved by then. And it should be at least 7 days from when the person first started feeling sick. So if they meet all those criteria, they could probably be pretty confident that they're it's safe and they're okay. That said, you know, they shouldn't let down on any of the things that we're all doing right now, you know, wearing a mask in public and staying 6 feet away from other people and that sort of thing.
I think we have time for one more, and this is from Casey, who asks, I've heard that CRISPR is being considered as a therapeutic for COVID-19. Can you please tell us how this might be implemented? And hats off to you, Rob, for explaining that as simply and briefly as you can.
Sure. CRISPR is that exciting new type of gene editing tool that's creating a lot of excitement in the scientific world for coming up with new ways to treat all sorts of diseases. The way that I've heard it being used possibly in this situation is they're developing tests actually based on CRISPR that could be a lot simpler to use and might not be subject to all the supply problems that some of these other tests have had. And there is actually a test that could be approved relatively soon. So that could be, you know, relatively soon on the horizon and to help with the testing shortages that we've been having all over the country.
All right, let me try to squeeze in one more, throwing that at you here. This is from Jim in Charlottesville, Virginia. And can we play that?
Why aren't we administering the tens of millions of tests every day that it seems like we need? This is a huge problem with the bureaucratic rules at the onset, but we were told that commercial labs were doing them. Why aren't they?
Yeah, so, you know, the commercial labs, it took a while for them to all get ramped up because of the initial delays that we had with the original CDC test that was flawed, and that sort of slowed things down at the very beginning. But once the FDA sort of relaxed its regulations, the commercial testing companies jumped in and did ramp up their testing pretty rapidly. And at the moment, they actually are doing the majority of testing that's happening in this country. But, you know, all the testing labs are subject to the same problems, the shortages of the supplies and the staff. And that's slowing all the labs down.
That is NPR Senior Science Editor and Correspondent Rob Stein. Rob, thanks so much for answering all those questions. We threw a lot at you today.
Sure, you bet. No problem.
This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Martin. Many of us are teleworking these days, and we're doing the best we can with video conference calls for work, school, religious services, even yoga classes. But some of the platforms have been the target of online harassment. Meetings have been disrupted with lewd images or racial slurs. This practice is being called Zoom bombing. And we do want to mention here that Zoom is a sponsor of NPR. So joining us now to answer your questions on the topic is NPR's business correspondent covering technology, Shannon Bond. Shannon, welcome.
Hi, Michelle.
So first of all, tell us a little bit more about what exactly a Zoom bomb is.
Yeah, so you sort of described it a little bit at the top there. You know, you're having a Zoom meeting. Say you're on the line with your coworkers, or maybe you're taking a class online. And some uninvited guest is basically hijacking the meeting. They're taking advantage of some of these sharing tools Zoom has to start playing porn on everyone's screen, or they make offensive comments or use racist slurs. And you can imagine this is really disruptive and upsetting for people. It's kind of the last thing we all need right now when our computer screens are these lifelines.
How about that? So I'm going to bring somebody into the conversation who's actually experienced this. Her name is Sarah. We're going to use only her first name to respect her privacy. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And I understand that these incidents happened during meetings with your AA recovery group, or? Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, they happened during several 12-step recovery groups. I guess at the beginning, most of us were not familiar with Zoom technology. And so we didn't know how to utilize any of the safety features, like, you know, our remove people from the meeting promptly. And so what would happen, and this was like maybe the second week, people would just come into the meeting. The meetings are open. There were no passwords. And then at some point, you know, imagery would come up. One time there was a swastika that came up, and then this was a women's meeting, so some derogatory language about women was put in the chat. Mm. You know, I can't say it on the air, but you get the picture. Yeah. And the whole goal is to disrupt.
That's awful.
Yeah.
Were people singled out? I mean, you think it was it sort of like a spray of awfulness, or were certain people singled out?
The first one was, and I thought that's what it would be, you know, very disturbing, but still somewhat anonymous. And then the next one was you know, you could see people's faces, and this person who was moderating was even less familiar with the technology. And so they weren't able to get the person out, you know, as quickly as before. And so they started fat shaming a woman in the meeting. You know, this is on top of a lot of other things, and they were laughing, and, you know, it's hate speech. You know, it's not just a prank call. It's hate awful. Speech, and it's disruptive. And now we've gotten to the point where I think they realize this, they were the ones being made fun of. You know, they're not really smart hackers breaking into something. You know, these meetings are open, the safety features are on, and you're just being, to put it politely, a jerk. But also, it's hate speech, so the FBI has opinions about it, too.
Okay. Thanks so much for sharing that with us, as painful as it is. I appreciate your talking about it. I know it wasn't pleasant to revisit it by talking with us about it, but thank you for sharing that experience. So,
Thank you for bringing up the topic.
Yeah. Shannon, you've done a lot of reporting on this. Have you been hearing similar stories like this?
Yeah, unfortunately, I have. Sarah's really not alone. I mean, I talked to a graduate student whose doctoral dissertation defense was disrupted. Somebody started drawing genitalia and slurs on his screen, and his whole family was on the call here. I've also heard from local officials, you know, with these virtual town halls. They're trying to keep people informed about what's going on with their community, give them important information about services. And those are getting attacked, too. And as Sarah said, it's really an issue, in particular for meetings where you want to make them open. You want to let people participate. You know, you want the public to join in, but people are really exploiting this.
Another listener called in with a similar experience. I want to play that. Here it is.
Hi, I'm an alcoholic, and I attend recovery meetings to help me stay sober. And I was in a meeting that was Zoom bombed, and it was very disruptive. My question is, how can Zoom come up with a creative solution to allow the links to be public, but the Zoom meeting itself to be private, so that we can make sure that we're as accessible as possible, but also taking care of people's anonymity and right to privacy?
So Shannon, I assume that you've been reaching out to Zoom to talk about security. What has the company said?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what this listener just asked, a lot of people are asking that. So Zoom says it is cracking down. It's halted all work on other projects to focus right now on security and privacy. And it's rolled out some important changes that should help protect people's meetings. So, you know, now have to enter a password to get into a meeting. The host has to actually let you in. You can't just join. Those are now defaults. You know, there's a button you can report an intruder in a meeting to Zoom so they could block that person. Now, you might wonder why these weren't already default settings. But I think what you have to remember here, like why we're seeing so much trouble, is that up until a few months ago, Zoom was really a business tool. Like, we certainly weren't using it in our day-to-day lives. They were selling their meeting software to companies. And so now all kinds of regular people are using it, and they're really just having to catch up to this to make it easier.
Shannon, as briefly as you can, what should somebody do if this happens to them?
They should certainly report it to Zoom, but in the first, they also need to do more to protect themselves in the first place. So don't post your meeting link and your password online or on social media. You know, don't share it more widely than you need to. Get to know those settings, turning off the ability for other people to share their screen or to write on your screen. It's called annotation. You just got to really get to know the software. And they are, as I said, they are trying to make it a little easier for people to see those things.
That is NPR business correspondent Shannon Bond. Shannon, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Sarah and our other listeners for sending those questions in and those experiences, as unpleasant as they were. So we appreciate that. Before we end today, we want to take a minute to highlight some of the funnier lessons we've learned about video calls in the past few weeks. First, if you're going to go pantsless on a conference call, you may want to make sure the video is turned off before you stand up and give yourself a little scratch, let's say.
Donnie!
Donnie! Can you hear us?
Donnie!
Oh, no. Don't. Jen, call him. Oh, my gosh.
And then there are all the fun features of video calls to try out, like the woman who tried out the potato filter but couldn't figure out how to get rid of it and conducted the rest of the meeting as a potato. And here's a reminder from the cast of Saturday Night Live.
No, please don't bring it into the bathroom. We can see you always.
I didn't know. Okay, my screen is dark again. Darn it.
No, don't take your clothes off, Nan.
So to all of you, stay safe, wash your hands, and don't forget to mute yourselves. And one more thought for today. If you are a recent graduate and have questions about finding a career in this difficult time, we would like to help. Go to npr.org/nationalconversation or on social media, use the hashtag NPRConversation. This is The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News.